What a warm and wondrous time, so sweet a shining moment in the sun. Oh, what a time, was there ever such a time? Then suddenly it's done, the moment passes. Where does the time go? Must we let it end? Where does the time go?
Time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end?
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Today is October the 5th, 2012, our first October 2012 broadcast. Of course, we're every Friday from 1 to 2, and you can listen on the internet from our website, whfr.fm, to any of these shows, because they're archived there, and you can listen as a stream or download them and go out jogging with them. I can always horrendously imagine people jogging and then they hear something I say, some bad pun, and then they trip and fall, you know, because they're laughing so hard, of course.
You? Bad pun?
No. Okay. I'm joined here in the studio by Dennis Reimars, who is our WHFR news director, who knows a pun or two himself.
Well, yes.
Okay.
I can be very punny.
Yes, right.
Boy.
That looks better in print, because sometimes it's spelled puny, you know.
Yeah, but everything I say looks better in print.
Well, no. Anyway, a couple late-breaking stories here. We do have a special guest that we promote on the on our website for upcoming today. If we have a special guest scheduled, then we like to put it there on the website homepage to give you extra incentive to tuning in. But, you know, we're trying to interview challengers and third-party candidates, sometimes one and the same, for local elective offices. That's something the other stations are just not doing. And WHFR, we do what the others don't do, but maybe should be doing more of. And so we have Priscilla Parnes, who is a Republican, and gee whiz, you know, that's one of the big parties, I'm told. But she is the challenger in the 15th district, which is mostly Dearborn, for the Michigan House seat that is now held by George DeRaney, Democrat. And so we're going to be talking to her today. She gave us her time, and she should be arriving, and she should be in the last quarter of this hour, so about 1:45. If you're listening right now, she'll be she's expected to begin her interview at that time. We'll ask her what her beliefs are, her background, and make her case for why you should vote for her rather than George DeRaney, because in fact there's no Green Party or Libertarian candidate running for that office, so it's a choice between the two of them.
You know, and you brought up a really good point. When we can, we try to put something on the website to give people a heads up, or even on in a previous week to let people know. But mm-hmm. I want our listeners to know that we cast a pretty wide net for a lot of different people, and some of them are on the national stage, and we may not know until the morning of, like a Friday morning, that somebody's going to be on the show. That was the case with Ralph Nader. So that's a good reason for everybody to listen in as often as possible.
Yeah, even if there's no story there, it's business as usual is pretty eclectic, and often we surprise ourselves. I've got a couple of stories like that aren't even in the local papers, and we love the Dearborn Times Herald and the Dearborn Press and Guide for the job that they do, but you know, their papers, they're only once, or in the case of Press and Guide, twice a week, and things happen every day, and sometimes twice a day even. So between the cracks, before the big stories, dearborn.patch.com, they do cover things, and they cover them quite well, quite nicely, equally in-depth stories to what you see in the papers usually, in most cases. But they certainly scoop the papers, but that's the nature of their medium. And you can get, by the way, no extra plug here, I do think you should subscribe, that is, pay the money up front. The local Dearborn weekly papers are well worth it. If you pay the money in advance, you'll get them automatically at your home each week, and twice a week for the Dearborn Press and Guide. And those are very, very valuable for all kinds of reasons. And we do want to keep the newspapers going for what they do especially well. But Patch.com, you can get their emails for free. Their updates every day for free. You just give them your email address, and they'll send their daily summary. Okay, two things. One is there was a Dearborn School Board candidates forum set up by the League of Women Voters in Dearborn. And two incumbents and one familiar face made their case for election to the Dearborn Board of Education at a forum this week sponsored by, as I said, the League of Women Voters. And that was Tuesday night, I believe. And the three people running for two seats here in Dearborn is Mary Lane. She's currently president of the 7-member school board, which is also the same thing as the Henry Ford Community College Board of Trustees. Amy Blackburn, who's been a longtime school board member, and Mary Petchlikoff, she's a past board trustee and was for quite a few years, but they're seeking, two of them will each get a 6-year term on the board. Wow, that's a long time. It's longer than a governor, yep. Longer than a single presidential term. I don't know about that 6-year term. Of course, people can always, if they get busy or they can't continue, they could just quit, I guess, and somebody else would be put in. But still, I don't know. 6-year term, that's a lot of stability, and I don't know. I'm just wondering whether or not that's good to have those certain people there for so long. I've met Amy Blackburn, interviewed her on the show once, and I've met and talked to, not on the show, Mary Petchlikoff at a sustainability conference. So she gets around to a lot of community issues here. Mary Lane, I just haven't met. Just can't comment on her, and I'm not telling you who to vote for here. But in the debates there, if you want to call it that, of course, the issues for the schools are educational achievement. We've got to get the kids better educated. We've got to keep them in school, too. I mean, the high school dropout rate, even in Dearborn, is much higher than it should be, and that's an interesting problem that we can't comment extensively about here. Of course, as a teacher for 45 years now, I think I have some strong opinions on both educational achievement and and also retention, as it's called at the college. People have to get a high school degree, and then they really, you know, as a life choice to make your future life as good as it can be, not only for the best job, but also to make the best lifestyle choices, you need higher education. You need community college education and or maybe a four-year degree or even postgraduate, depending on what you're going to get involved in. You can't do the good stuff or make good choices without education. And there's a lot of choices, you know, which schools and which program you're going to major in. And so you need good counseling, you need to do good research. And a lot of things to say about that. They basically seem to say, well, since we don't have much money, Amy Blackburn said, we need to apply a cost/benefit analysis, just like they do in business. Well, that is always, I hate that term, because I know that good education inspires students, and try to put a cost-benefit analysis on inspiration, enthusiasm, motivation.
Right.
I dare you. I mean, really, Amy and others, you know, that's the outcome you really want here. You want somebody that loves to learn, that knows that they don't know everything, and they know where to find the information, and they're willing to persevere. They're willing to keep looking. They're going to be dedicated people because they're inspired by their need to know and the knowledge that they don't know everything.
You're talking about the instructor has to have those
And the teachers.
That's what I mean. The teachers
have to be a good example of that, but then the students need to become that same sort of learner.
But as part of this conversation that these three candidates had, they also talked about teacher evaluation, did they not?
Well, they didn't, in this article, they're not talking about that. But of course, teacher evaluation and teacher accountability, if you will, is part of the whole thing. They do, all three of them criticize the so-called adequate yearly progress measure that the state of Michigan puts on them. And they say that's just not accurate. It's not appropriate based on the kind of students we have in Dearborn, not just the ESL or English as second language students, but also so many vocational programs that are not necessarily intended to get people up to getting ready for a college degree. So they think the AYP, as it's called, should be based on progress, not target. And I'd just like to say on the record here, as a teacher of 45 years here, that the American Federation of Teachers is the union that represents both the K-12 and the Henry Ford Community College teachers, two different chapters, as they call them. But we started teacher evaluation and accountability before the administrators. We started more than a decade ago, and I think it was probably 15 years ago. I know when I was administrator from 1988 to 98 for the Performing Arts Department here at HFCC, we started right in the middle of that. So what is that? In the early 90s. Mm-hmm. So that's, oh my gosh, 90s, that's 22 years ago. So don't tell me the teacher unions, certainly not here in Dearborn, aren't interested in and wanting to implement good teacher evaluation and accountability. That's absolutely false here. And I don't want to hear anybody say that because they don't know what they're talking about here in Dearborn. Now, my daughter, she's a teacher in Southfield. She has the MEA, the Michigan Education Association, as her teacher union. And they have different positions on some of the issues, but they also know the evaluation, accountability. I just sort of bottom line and think about this, folks. If you had to choose who's going to evaluate the teachers, who would know the best, who would know who the worst are, in fact, and the best, it's the other teachers. I mean, you know, teachers know what teaching is all about collectively, and the group of teachers in those schools and in that district, they know who the underachieving teachers are.
Sure.
And we'd love to give them help. In some cases, if they're given help, stimulus, encouragement by the other teachers, you know, then they can come up to standard or become more exceptional. But they don't, you know, these programs don't, these evaluation training programs, accountability programs, they generally just say, well, if they don't make the standard, maybe warn them once and then we'll get rid of them. And I don't think that's fair for someone at their job. I mean, even in the workplace, sure, the business owner can fire somebody if they don't think they've been performing properly. But I think since they're employees that have been there for a while, they should give them a chance and even offer some way to train them to come up to standard or transfer them to another position. And you say, well, all teachers are the same. Yeah, but they're often teaching different subject matters. I know a few of the teachers that I found inadequate in high school, junior high, high school, and college, they were teachers that were forced to teach outside their subject area.
Right.
Because there wasn't enough teachers, they didn't want to hire more. And so one of the worst teachers I ever had was for physics. But that's because he was the best teacher I ever had in algebra. He was an algebra major. Okay. He knew how to do it. He's brilliant. And then you say, well, physics, that's kind of like another science. That shouldn't be a problem. He only had one class in physics in college. And I don't know if he did well or not. But oh, and then they lost the teacher manual, you know, with the answers for the textbook. And he didn't know what the answers were either for any of the problems.
Oh, no.
It was a disaster. It wasn't his fault. He was forced to teach outside of his subject area. He was a brilliant teacher, master teacher in algebra, but not in physics. And, you know, with all due respect to administrators and student evaluations, and there's nothing wrong with all of those you know, figured into the mix, the people who best know who the underachieving teachers are teachers. And they're also the best people to come up with a plan to give these people at least a second chance and support to improve their skills or their approaches. That's the only fair and honest thing to do here, even in difficult times. That won't. So I'm just saying, in Dearborn, we've got that accountability. We've got the teacher evaluations. Sure, the schools collectively will work with the teacher evaluations, and I think they should work with administration evaluations. Do we have any? I don't know. And even support staff. My daughter, Southfield, they went and outsourced all the janitorial help at the schools. And she's been there 12 years. In the last 5 years, they started an outside private company. They don't clean your blackboard. They don't clean the student desks. They don't clean the floors inside the classrooms.
Well, they do empty the garbage?
Just the hallways. The hallways. Yeah, they empty the trash in the hallways. So she's got to do that herself. She has to bring in the cleaning supplies herself. And then she has the students. She provides the handy wipes so they can wipe down all the desktops so that they're sanitary. I never heard of that. You know, in the good old, and then she goes to a janitor, even during the day, there's one around, or maintenance person, whatever they're called. They don't know the schools. They're part-timers. They have no feeling or affinity to the schools. They don't love that school. They're not hired by the school, paid by the school. There's no value to them to get to know the teachers or the problems or to solve problems. That's a disaster. You know, why would kids want to go to school if they even notice how dirty they are? And this is not true in Dearborn at this point. I don't think we've outsourced janitorial in Dearborn. But, you know, certain cost-cutting things, they'll come back to bite you. And moving on to...
We haven't, by the way. And in fact, the same maintenance people that work here at the college are part of the Dearborn Public Schools.
Right. They are, although we have an awful lot of part-timers, not full-timers now.
True.
But at least they're hired here. They know this is who pays them.
Exactly.
And it is important for them to relate to the teachers, administrators, the people who use these buildings in a professional way. So that at least, even if you have to go to part-time without benefits, that's got to be demoralizing. But, at least it's something to know that you're being paid directly, and if you do something wrong, you will be brought to task almost immediately.
Sure.
So, because all you can really do with these outsourced companies, really, is that the school board eventually will note that they're not doing the job, and maybe after a couple of contracts, they'll say, oh, we're not going to continue.
Right.
If anybody else bids to take it over, though. If nobody else bids, I guess you're sort of stuck.
Well, that's a pretty good gig in Southfield if you don't have to do the desks or the floor or the blackboard. So,
I just don't understand. She spends like an hour a day cleaning.
Really?
As part of her teacher salary, which is reduced 10% by contract this year, not to mention the other takeaways that the legislature has put in place.
You know, and it's not
salary,
like,
retirement, and so on.
It's not like she can run out and go to a different district because none of them are doing extremely well, you know?
No, but she doesn't have, you know, tenure's done away with. She could be fired at any time.
True.
Just the principal says doesn't like her. That's the other law that the Republican-controlled legislature and governor signed into law this last year. So everybody knows they could be gone the next minute. So there's not a lot of morale left in many of the schools because of that. And I think morale feeds into that enthusiasm and that teaching ability and that environment for the students to want to you know, rise to the occasion too. But anyway, here's that other thing where maybe it's short-sighted. There's a story in Patch.com Wednesday. Dearborn looks at elimination of drug court program. You know, this is the there's no state funding for it. Court and city officials disagree over whether funding of the $35,000 per year program should continue. And since it started in 2002, the state received $9.4 million in requests for Michigan Drug Court Grant Program, of which only $2.1 million was granted. But still, we got some money towards it. So that $35,000 that Dearborn spends annually to run the program no longer exists, leaving the city with two options: fund the program independently or cut it entirely. Well, a discussion among Mayor Jack O'Reilly and city council members this last Tuesday revealed the city is leaning toward the latter option, cut it out. But would like to first review the court's budget as well as the status of the program.
This program, what it does, it's designed to do is to give first-time offenders a break. And so, in other words, they would have the ability to have their records clean after a certain period of time, probationary period, whatever, community service, right?
Right. Currently, there's 23 participants in the drug court program in Dearborn, all in various stages of the program. If the program is ended, participants would either have to be moved to other drug courts or retried and sentenced in Dearborn. And even Judge Wiganek, Chief Judge, and Judge William Hulkgren requested via memo to the city that the city fund the program through at least the end of 2012. That's only a couple more months, though.
Right.
Of course, Judge Mark Summers, who oversees the drug court, went a step further with his request, penning a memo saying that drug courts work and that the city should continue to budget for the program this year and for years to come, regardless of state support. And it has been proven, and it's not in the story, but the commentaries have proven, too, is that with this extra money spent on rehabilitation, it pays back. It pays back the cost to the city, because you have less crime, less drug-related crime, that these drug courts have been proven to be a good deal. Sure, you got to set them up front, but it's a good financial deal because it saves the courts money in the long run. It also helps these people. I mean, think about it, if I may pontificate here. Remember, all opinions expressed in this show are not necessarily the opinion of anyone else at Henry Ford Community College here, but why is it, do you think, that Michigan has the highest percentage of its population in prisons? Huge number. High percent, more than any other state in the United States. Higher percentage of Michigan population is in prison here. I suggest poor education, poor health care, okay? Maybe we need more money on crime prevention and also enforcement. But the courts are flooded with cases. And in fact, the district court here, as we've heard from Judge Wiganek and Judge Summers, is handling more than their fair share, more than what three full-time judges should be able to handle, according to the State of Michigan Judicial Review Board. And they want to cut the budget in Dearborn? I know everything's tight, but you know, a good functioning court system with rehabilitation in mind, not just revolving door, send them to prison, have them come out and do the same crime or two or three more that they learned how to do in prison. It doesn't make sense, folks. We need to focus on appropriate punishment for the situation and rehabilitation intervention at the lower levels first. It'll cost a lot less for us to do it here than for the state to try to do it working out of Jackson Prison or something.
So
that's my opinion on this. I've already gave the qualifier, Dennis.
Okay, good.
Yeah, he just stepped out for a second. I think we'd be penny wise and pound foolish, as the British used to say, if we get rid of the drug court or even cut the budget at all for the 19th District Court. And that's been, you know, that's from the inside out. That's what I know and talking to two of the three judges personally and reading the reviews from the State of Michigan Judicial Board.
When the three judges so emphatically support it, that's a good sign. you know?
Yes.
And it makes make their job easier. Let's face it. Mm-hmm. It makes it a lot easier. And I don't know. I would like to see the statistics on how
many. Well, of course, Wygonik and Holmgren, they just said at least it funded for the rest of the year. Whereas Summers, who instituted the program, and it was a great idea, a cost-saving thing, and of course, he's in charge of it. In fact, no extra cost, by the way. He still does the largest number of cases compared to Holmgren and Wygonik. And he even did that when he was Chief Justice, but he does this because it's the right thing to do in order to help these people locally to overcome their drug addictions and get them pushed in the right direction a little bit. City officials, though they do say, they're skeptical of Summers' position, given that only 8 of the program's 59 participants graduated during the year 2011. Well, that's 8 less that, it's, still 8 that probably won't come back again. You know, if you don't rehabilitate at all, maybe all 59 will do the same crime again. So, but nationwide, it's been clearly shown that these kinds of drug courts are a cost saving in the long run. Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Moving on then.
Time.
Here's an opinion. I know people, what's your comment on the presidential debates? I'm just saying, and this is unbiased, but the fact checkers say both Romney and Obama didn't get their facts straight. They both exaggerated and they lied to in one place or the other. Romney, I was quite surprised that he sounded like a Democrat. He was back to being a Massachusetts governor. I don't know how the Republicans took that. They probably said, well, good tactic. Yeah. Good tactic, because once you get elected, then you can do anything you want to do.
That's right.
Of course, I think some of the Republicans are now thinking, wait a minute, if he gets elected and he does that stuff, we don't like that. So we don't like, he basically said, I don't got to get Obamacare out of there. But then he went on to say, in the states, every state should have it, just like Massachusetts, where they now cover 98%. Well, doesn't that work out the same if every state has exactly the same as Obamacare, but state-based? It's just, there's more local control that way, perhaps, but there'll be differences between the states. So a lot of people will maybe want to move to another state that has a slightly better Obamacare-type program in its state.
It's possible.
I don't know. So I couldn't believe. And then, of course, he had to attack PBS and Big Bird and Jim Lehrer, who was sitting there as the moderator. No excuse there. And the cost of PBS in general support from the government is so small compared to all the other economic things. It won't make a ripple of difference. But the fact checkers say, hey, the numbers don't add up. Romney's numbers don't add up. He's, I'm going to save here. I'm going to reduce taxes there. They don't make sense. They don't add up. And even Obama's numbers, wasn't very clear about them, I'm sorry to say. They don't make sense. So I didn't learn anything. It was kind of boring. It was all about economics. Sure, Romney looked better because he was talking quicker than Obama. And he was looking at Obama more. So in those bit of performance details, which means nothing about how good you are as a president, he came off better. But these glamour details mean nothing. I mean, how's the person going to run the country in the Oval Office? That's a question for me. And so debates like these, now they could have other types, but debates like these don't mean much.
But they're targeting the less intelligent observer, somebody that's maybe just now getting on board.
And with no disrespect, if you aren't well-educated on, for example, all the ballot proposals that are coming up, we need to tell you that League of Women Voters says, okay, of course, get registered, and you have until Tuesday at 4:30, I think it is.
Yep.
Here it is.
You got it.
When the city clerk's offices close in your area to register to vote in November. So if you're not registered, you can't vote. Now, once you've proven your citizenship and your address and you're registered to vote, by the way, don't believe anything anybody else said. You don't have to even check that citizenship, I am a citizen box, because you had to be one to register. Some areas like Dearborn probably won't have that box on the ballot. Our Secretary of State, Republican, she wanted it there. The governor didn't want it there because for the reason that all these voter ID things that Republican legislatures have tried to pass in several states have now been pretty much nixed by the courts in those states. Why? Because not enough time to give people a chance who don't have the appropriate kind of ID to get one. And so they just couldn't vote, even though they're citizens. In fact, I saw, and I don't know why this worked out, but it's true, at least at this point it's true, Jim Cramer, who's that money market analyst on, is it CNBC? Or,
yeah.
He's got a regular
it's
show.
Cramer's Money or something.
Yeah, Madman Cramer or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Or is that some sort of appliance store guy one day? But he does go crazy. And, of course, he never saw a 2008 crash coming. So he was,
yeah.
You know, he was really blindsided by that. He apologized afterwards.
Well, that's good.
He lost a bunch of money, too, yeah. Apparently. But his dad, because of voter ID, wherever his dad lives, can't vote.
Really?
His dad. I mean, Cramer's rich. I assume he shares some money with his father.
Maybe not.
And his father is elderly. And for some reason, this is how it was reported on TV, because he's elderly, he can't vote. What? So that's, and because that was a new law that was passed by the Republican legislature and signed by the Republican governor wherever he lives, whether it's Wisconsin or whatever. And now he's disenfranchised for no good reason. No good reason at all. It's not that he's blind or deaf. In fact, I think you can vote if you're blind and deaf. Other people can help you. But he, you know, so this is terrible. You don't do these things at the last minute. And that was Governor Snyder's feeling, too, about it. So don't worry. But you do need a picture ID.
Mm-hmm.
They will ask for that when you go to vote. If you don't have one, they'll still let you vote.
Yes.
It'll still be counted. You just have to sign an affidavit, a little piece of paper. No big deal. It's affidavit, they call it. But a little piece of paper that says, I am who I say I am.
That's right.
Okay? So don't be afraid. If you're registered to vote, you don't have the little card with you, you know, like which precinct. But if you go to the right precinct, if not, they'll send you to the right precinct. They got a list of who's in what precinct. So they'll send you to the right place if you don't know where your polling place is. Although when you register, they'll tell you.
Right.
Sometimes they change, like in Dearborn Heights, though. So,
yeah, they did.
Yeah. So, but you don't need to take any ID with you, actually, once you're registered. So you've only got through Tuesday, next week Tuesday, October 9th at 4:30. Go directly to your city clerk's office or your township clerk's office at your city hall, probably, or township hall, and get registered. And help other people you know who aren't registered. Because they say, well, I don't think I'm going to vote. Well, If they discover in the next month a reason to vote, but then they're not registered, they can't vote.
That's right.
So, you know, you've got to be ready to vote, and you should vote, I think, but an educated voter is better, obviously. Everybody's recommending also the absentee ballot.
Absolutely. That's okay? What I was going to bring up.
And you say, well, I can't get one because I'm not old enough or I'm not sick yet.
You're going to be out of town.
I intend to be in town. Okay, tell them you're probably going to be out of town. Okay. I mean, lie about it if you have to, okay? If you don't qualify by the several criteria, I would actually say you're probably going to be out of town. You know, you could be. Who knows? You might find a reason to drive somewhere, right?
Jay told me to lie. No,
that's
he's
right.
Not really.
Yeah. No.
He's
well, it's not a lie if you say, I expect to be out of town.
That's true. That's
you
true.
Know, plans change, okay?
Absolutely.
And that's because the ballot is so long. When I went to vote411.org, which is the League of Women Voters national site, and I put in my address, and they gave me the sample ballot from my area. It was a little bit wrong because it had Wayne County Community College issues, and here in Dearborn, we pay money to Henry Ford Community College. So we're not part of that Wayne County issue. We don't vote on that at all. It's not on our Dearborn ballot, but they thought it was. But everything else, they do explain, like even for the presidential office, what does a president do? They have that information in there for every single office. Oh. And then for the ballot proposals, pro and con. A paragraph or two, long paragraphs at least, for both opinions on both sides of all the ballot proposals. And so it comes out 40 pages
when
you print it out, at least in my case.
But the actual ballot itself, at least in Dearborn Heights, is 2 pages front and back. That's it.
I can't believe that.
That's true. I saw it.
Because you're in Wayne County. There's five proposals for Wayne County ballot, too.
Just the ballot itself, where you can vote. We had the sample ballots. This is what I was going to tell you, that I interviewed the city clerk for Dearborn Heights, Walter Pershevitz, and we went through all this, and I learned something. Maybe you knew this, but if you...
Well, the ballot might be 2 pages, but the actual, that's just the what you have to check
that's
things
the physical
off on.
Ballot, right?
Yeah,
right.
I mean, what you're actually looking at in that little booklet in the
booth. Oh,
that's probably at least 10 or 12 or 15
absolutely.
Pages long.
Yep.
Okay, it's small too. So you need to either get a sample ballot from your clerk's office or go to vote411.org and look at it on site.
You're allowed to bring it in with you.
Yes, you can bring in any sort of little list or a cheat sheet or whatever you want to in with you into the polling place. But it's better to get it sent to you. Okay, if you're registered to vote, you either go into the office and pick one up from the city clerk's office or call them. You have to fill out a little application to get one, and including check off that box about being out of town.
Right.
expect to be out of town. And they'll send it to you, I assume, towards the end of next week because the cutoff for registration is Tuesday. And so I've already got my request in. You can put that request in now, by the way, with your city clerk if you want to, and get it sent to you. And then you can sit down at home, spread out all the material on the table, and think about things, talk to people, listen to this show and other shows, read the newspapers, and then make the best decision. You have to get it back to them, certainly by voting day, November 6th, but you know, I think the deadline is maybe the day before or something.
No, it's that day. It's the voting day at 8 o'clock, but you have to take it to the city clerk, not to the polling.
Yeah, if you put it in the mail, I think you should do it by Friday, November 3rd.
Absolutely.
I think.
And I did learn something. If you change your mind and decide not to do the absentee ballot and you want to go in and actually vote, then you would go to the voting spot in your precinct, bring your absentee and exchange it for a regular ballot. That's how they do it. They switch it off.
Good to know. Yes. Okay, sure.
But once
you set it in, I think it's done.
Yes. It does not go to the where you would go to vote. That goes to the city clerk's office. That absentee ballot does.
Right.
That's what I learned.
Yep. Okay. So very important, folks. And remember Tuesday, October 9th, deadline to register, but also you can get the absentee ballot applications between 8 and 4:30 or call them, and I think they'll send the application to you through the mail, and then you have to send it back to them.
There's no way to do it online for an application?
Maybe.
I think so. In Dearborn Heights, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, good old Dearborn Heights.
Yeah. Okay. And people can I do
Oh, and of course, Fridays, the Dearborn Heights City Clerk is closed, so.
Oh, that's
right. You
can't
go on Fridays.
No, you're right. Good point. Yeah. But that seemed like a shameless plug for the show that I do because I hosted it with the city clerk. But we also had the League of Women Voters out the 27th of September, and it's currently showing a debate between for the open council seat. We couldn't get the county commissioners on there. We couldn't get a schedule. It was a schedule conflict. So we just had the Dearborn Heights City Council people.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty. Lisa Ferens and Mr. Kaczynski.
We usually feature Jim Hightower. I'm going to do two special spots. Just one commentary from Jim Hightower today. He is talking about Mitt Romney here, and it's just a sort of support for the prevarication I was mentioning. I think that means lying. Really on both sides, but he talks about Mitt Romney, but and the flip-flopping and so on. But here's Hightower's comment. We'll be back with more of the WHFR Journal shortly. We're expecting our guest, Priscilla Parnes, to be on the air with you by about 10 minutes from now.
Geez, does Mitt Romney's brain bone even connect to his tongue bone? He went haywire again in a recent TV interview, declaring that there's no need for the government to make sure that every American has health care coverage, for there's always the ER. Launching into a little anecdote to show his connectedness to the real world of not millionaires, Mitt explained that if someone has a heart attack, they don't sit in their apartment and die. We pick them up in an ambulance and take them to a hospital and give them care. Well, actually, since many uninsured Americans don't get any preventative care, they do indeed suffer a big one and die in their apartments. That aside, however, plenty of knowledgeable people have pointed out that emergency room care is exorbitantly expensive, so it's far more sensible to provide universal health care. One of these knowledgeable and sensible people was a guy named, guess who? Mitt Romney. Asked just 2 years ago if he supported universal coverage, Romney said, "Oh, sure. Look," he added, "it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to have millions and millions of people who have no health insurance and yet who can go to the emergency room and get entirely free care." The wandering presidential wannabe used to denounce the ER as a form of socialism and hailed mandatory health insurance as the ultimate conservatism. And don't forget that the guy who's now touting the ER as a health care plan is the same one who passed a mandatory health insurance program in Massachusetts specifically to limit emergency room overuse. And it worked. ER use is way down in Massachusetts, and 98% of Bay State residents now have health coverage, including 99.8% of children. This is Jim Hightower saying, maybe that old but effective 2006 Romney model could be brought back to replace this year's defective version of the Romney.
From APM, American Public.
Yes, I'm going to have you listen to that in just a minute. That's actually a special little five-minute report from Stephen J. Dubner. He has a podcast called Freakonomics Radio, and we sometimes feature it on the Monday Forum, which is on WHFR 89.3 FM from 6 to 7 p.m. and podcast. It is archived, and it's not on every week because we have a variety of different podcasts on the Monday Forum, but frequently we use Stephen Dubner and that. His comment is about why America's economic growth may be over. Yeah. Okay. And the fact that presidents can't do very much, no matter who they are, with jobs. Okay. And the economy in general. They really can't. They don't have the power. They cannot. There are no magic wands and so on. So we'll listen to that in just about a minute. I'll start that. And then we hope our guest interview will be here. Headlines. Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday. Christian group sues over Arab Fest incident. Yeah, here we go again. But the good news is they're not suing Dearborn this time, the Dearborn Police Department, because we were able to somehow work a deal with the Wayne County police force to come in. So Benny Napoleon and his crew are being sued by this group for supposedly infringing on their rights to freedom of speech and so on at the Arab Fest here in Dearborn a few months ago. Good news, the Dearborn Hyatt Hotel, November 1st, will be the Radisson Hotel. I was afraid it might become a Motel 6. I've stayed at many Radisson hotels. There's a beautiful one in Lansing and also one in Austin, Texas. I've stayed in many times, and they're fine. They're not quite as expensive as Hyatts and other upscale hotels, but they're clean. They're fine. They're really good. I mean, they're really much better than, I'm sorry. I don't want to put down a Motel 6. I haven't stayed there, but you know, at least this is a classy name, and it is a 16-story iconic building in Dearborn here. And so they think they can do a really big conference business. And I don't remember when the last conference came to the Dearborn Hyatt. I don't remember any sort of popular conferences being there recently. So no wonder they had to sell. It's finalized, folks, Dearborn Heights. And if Dennis, who was gone out to greet our guest, was here, he'd say Dearborn Heights and Allen Park Fire Departments have now a mutual aid agreement. It's finalized. And in fact, Allen Park and Dearborn Heights in South Telegraph area, south of like the Dearborn area, they're almost contiguous, Allen Park and Dearborn Heights in that area. And so it's a mutual aid agreement. It's not a merging, although apparently Dennis said that Dearborn Heights is actually considering merging their fire department with I see our special guest is here. So I'm going to put on Stephen J. Dubner, and I'll be right back.
Cowan, an economist that you've had on this program before.
You bet.
He's coined...
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdahl.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, welcome back, man. I missed you.
I missed you too, Kai. Thanks for having me.
I love you, man.
I'm guessing you're going to be in front of your TV tonight for the debate?
I am, yes. Of course I am. In point of fact, also live tweeting, and it's on marketplace.org. So if you're lonely, you know where you can go.
Very good. You know, the focus of this first presidential debate, as you know, is domestic policy. So I am assuming we're going to hear an awful lot about the economy, yes?
One would certainly hope, right? I mean, that's what we're waiting for these two men who want to be the most powerful man in the world to help us fix the American economy, right?
So, Kai, let me say two things about this. Okay? The first,
okay.
I have said on your program before,
yes.
And I probably will again,
okay.
Is that the U.S. president has much less influence over the economy than we actually think.
Yeah, but we have to pretend, right? Come on.
We have to pretend. My second point is actually more heretical than that. My second point is this. There are people out in the world who will argue with you that the great age of American economic growth is just over. Okay, here's Robert Gordon, an economist at Northwestern.
Okay.
We had a century of relatively rapid productivity growth between, say, 1870 and 1970, and then it slowed down. And a major puzzle for the economics profession was to figure out, why did it slow down?
Okay, so A, did they figure it out? And B, what about computers and automation and technology and increased productivity? Hello?
Excellent questions.
I know.
So, okay, here's the way Robert Gordon explains it. There have been three what he calls industrial revolutions over the past couple centuries. The first one was, you know, steam power and railroads.
Yeah, it was
big
the
time.
Industrial revolution, right? Yeah.
That was a big one. But yeah. The second one that we're really most thankful for included things like electricity, the internal combustion engine and the fuels to run it, clean water. And his argument is that the computer revolution is just not as potent as the ones that came before it.
Hello, has this man never heard of the iPhone? I mean, come on. That changed my life. And there are people who will be amazed to hear me say that.
I'm glad it changed your life. It's changed my life, too. But his argument is this, is that what a lot of technology does is make things that already existed more portable and more flexible, our entertainment, our communication. And obviously, we're all thankful for that. But when you compare that to things like mass transportation and electricity, heating and air conditioning, the computer era does not produce those kind of gains.
Okay, so not to get all downer on you here, but if the iPhone and all that it represents is what we have now to propel us forward, are we fundamentally doomed? I mean, is America going to, you know?
No. And nobody's saying that. What you are starting to hear is a description of, America's golden age of growth may have been exactly that, a golden age, which by its nature cannot last forever, okay? Mm-hmm. Tyler Cowen, an economist that you've had on this program before, he's coined a name for the current U.S. economy. He calls it the Great Stagnation, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, that said, Cowen is a big believer that new technology, artificial intelligence, for instance, will lead to further growth. He thinks that Robert Gordon's prediction, therefore, is probably a little bit too grim.
I think our ability to forecast future growth has never been all that great. So about the future, I'm actually fairly optimistic.
Yeah, which is great, but what if, Dubner, right? What if Gordon's right, and what if you're right, and that the greatest growth is behind us? Then what?
Well, look, it may be, and again, these are predictions, and you know how I feel about predictions. They're mostly worthless, but it may be, however, time to start thinking about the U.S. economy, not so much in terms of never-ending growth, which we've been trained to do, but in terms of a different word, which is sustainability, essentially, right? Which isn't necessarily the worst thing in the world.
And of course, that's what we're going to hear the President and Governor Romney talk about tonight, right? Not about growth.
Are you kidding me? No. First of all, they both need to preserve this fiction that the president controls the economy. But beyond that, to get on TV, okay, picture this and to say, you know, my fellow Americans, our great age of growth was wonderful and it's over. Welcome to the new season of sustainability.
Wow.
I do not see that
That'd
as a big vote
awesome.
Getter. They will do what politicians always do. They will promise a bigger and brighter economic future. Because if there's one thing, Kai, that politicians are really good at, it's making promises that they have absolutely no ability to keep.
Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We will talk to you again in a couple of weeks, man. See ya.
See ya, Kai. Thanks.
So we hope that was amazing to you. Stephen J. Dubner of Freakonomics Radio is always revealing the practical side, the economic realities that, the general statements often from presidential candidates don't really reflect the practical realities that research can reveal. And so his two books, Freakonomics and Super Freakonomics, have sold very well, and he does have his own website and podcast, and we do feature his commentaries there, of course, for you to decide if you agree or not. And now in the studio, we have our guest as scheduled, Priscilla Parnes. Welcome to the new WHFR Journal.
Thank you very much.
You are the Republican candidate for 15th District Michigan House. And let me start. Of course, we want some background information for those people that haven't met you before or heard your name before. Let me start with the big question. And this is not rarely asked, but why did you choose to be a Republican?
Well, I've always been one, but I chose to be one.
Okay.
My parents were Republican, but some of my father and mother's families were Democrats, so we had lively discussions always since I can remember. And I've always chosen the Republican because I feel that we need less government, less taxes, and more accountability for our actions in our country. I believe in the wilderness spirit, the going out and doing it yourself, improving things by doing it yourself, get involved. And that's one of the reasons why I went ahead and decided to run for this office.
And and also, you've been involved with Republican, as you told me earlier, with the Republican Party locally, precinct delegate, and so on. So you understand the sort of functioning of the party structure, and so you sort of have insider's view of how politics works, which is amazing to a lot of people who only see it from the outside, which is the majority of people. At least it was for me years ago when I was a member of a particular party, and also a lobbyist group, which I'm very proud of, Common Cause. It still exists today, but I was a local coordinator for Common Cause. And so we worked with politicians, Republicans, Democrats in office, and we saw behind the scenes, not just how a bill is made, but what the pressures are, the compromises, and how maybe if a bill is called something like the Patriot Act, there may be details that are actually not quite so patriotic. And sometimes it's because of compromise. To get the good stuff passed, you had to compromise a little bit. John Dingell always talked extensively. Whenever I talk to him, I say, why did you vote on this? It was a good compromise. Well, of course, with any compromise, there's some things that are not quite so favorable to certain people. But it is part of what politics is about. You need the leverage, the wherewithal to get things passed, and you do try to, of course, help the majority of people most of the time. You know, and so good for you at choosing to try to be this representative. How do you see this position? Obviously, you have to go to Lansing. You have to vote on bills. You're ready to relocate, I guess George Urania got an apartment up there in Lansing, and he comes back, I think, 3 days a week down here. But
well, that's basically what I would want to do also. I don't want to lose my grassroots connections. Mm-hmm. I want to see what's going on. I was a teacher, and I was social studies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's very dear to me, making our government work for us. We are the employer of our government. So therefore, one of the things that's on here is term limits.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I very much am in favor of term limits, and I expect to always vote that way.
Oh, okay. Well, I listed four issues that they could come up, that could be reviewed once you get to Lansing. Usually they're very political. Term limits were put in place by a public vote, but they could be taken out by at least a majority or maybe two-thirds of the legislature. Our one of our previous mayors, and even our current mayor, Mayor Guido, and even John B. O'Reilly Jr., say, hey, we already have term limits in our democracy, and it's called elections. If you don't like someone's job, get them out. If they're doing a great job, you really should vote them in again. But there's always the cronyism. And even I've talked about this years ago, and no disrespect to the past mayor, but even Guido, after, was it three or four terms, 12 years, 14 years in office, many of his appointees were just like, I would say there were sort of political favors. I heard a lot of rumors, and these people can't really do the job, but it was he was a friend, or he did something for the last campaign. And so that does happen, is that people were in office longer rather than less, tend to start doing things that favor their support to solidify their place in office. And that's really not appropriate, but and unless it's outright illegal or they get caught, then it goes on in our system. Mm-hmm. So it's a ebb and flow there. I do think it has been unfortunate, just in my point of view here, that I at least know several examples of how term limits have prevented at least one more term or two from people that I thought were extremely well qualified for office. For example, well, he used to be Republican. Gary Warrenchuk was a representative, 15th District. He was Republican then. Okay, he became a Democrat, but I think that's because he wanted to get elected to something, and that was Wayne County Commissioner. Okay, he's a very pragmatic guy. But, I mean, I think he did a great job of representing us, and he just couldn't continue because term limits kept him from that. And whether or not you like Warrenchuk or the job he did, I'm just saying personally, just everybody can probably point out examples where term limits are not desirable. Maybe they are. He pointed out, as did... other legislators is, in fact, he pointed out, he said, well, I've been here 4 years now. I'm just starting to really learn how to get laws that I want to have happen be passed. That I've been guided by lobbyists, I've been guided by my party, and you know, I have no status really until I was here almost until the end of 4 years, until I could actually get a grasp on the game to play, who to know and what to do. So you're kind of a willing victim until you get fully educated. I know that the U.S. Congress actually has, they've set up, Democrats and Republicans have set up a little like workshops for the newbies.
Right. And actually they're doing it here in Lansing. Okay.
But
well,
it's usually the Democrats have workshops for the Democrats and then the Republican. But right. I think really should be workshops for both parties together. But yeah, you have to.
Could be.
That's one way to get around the, although I'm told by George Durrani that it's primarily you do what we tell you, the party workshops, and you'll be fine.
That's what he said when he started out. That
right.
was basically the direction.
Yeah.
I have to ask you, because of these short terms, it seems like as soon as whomever gets elected as a state rep, they're especially with the learning curve that was just we just talked about, then you're campaigning again.
Right.
I mean, it's like you're the first year you get to learn, and then you're back in the campaigning, and then of course, what is it, a three term limit?
Two
yes.
terms.
Is it two?
Three terms.
Three.
6 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that has to be, are you looking forward to that?
Well, I am not wanting to be a career politician.
Right.
And the fact that I do have a background in social studies, I've taught government, I've taught American government, I've studied politics, I've been involved in a lot of political campaigns. I ran Victory Centers in 08, I ran Victory Centers in 92. These are presidential elections, mm-hmm. very major ones where you had to know the issues. In other words, to be able to get out to the people, get the vote out, you needed to know the issues, or at least I felt I needed to know them.
And how to organize people and run the campaign office
exactly.
and so on. Yeah.
And all of this yeah. leads into serving in one of the legislatures mm-hmm. or serving in Congress. But if you go to Congress or to the legislature and you have no idea what you're doing, maybe you should do some homework first.
Yeah. No, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's probably accurate.
That would help.
We're talking to Priscilla Parnas, Republican candidate for 15th District in Michigan House, November 6th election here. We have about 5 minutes left in our interview, so can you give us any specific plans that you want to support, you want to be active in regard to, well, you know, the usual big topics are jobs or education, taxes, the environment. Obviously, you represent this Dearborn area, but some of these issues are about the same across the state. One or two program ideas, maybe, that you'd like to share with us?
Well, there's so many.
Yeah.
And since I was social studies, that meant that I liked everything. And unfortunately, to hone them down into one or two little blurbs, you can't. I would like to be very much involved in the job debate. I want to be involved in the health debate. I want to be involved in the education debate, the tax debate. I believe in everyone doing their part in saving our environment.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason to destroy the area around us. But do we do it by the government telling us what to do, or do we do it because we think we should be doing it?
You think it'll get done if some areas, like, for example, for years, the auto companies were telling the federal government, we can't possibly meet those economy guidelines, mileage mm-hmm. guidelines. And once they were put in place, they had no trouble meeting them at all. Now, there might be extra cost in the cars. Okay, I admit, you know, with the various, what's in platinum and a catalyst or some expensive minerals. So, you know, there's some cost involved, but for the sake of the cleaner environment, you know, like the I was going to ask you about the 2025 Proposal 3, asking for 25% renewable power in the state of Michigan by 2025. I realize several states have gone to, like California, we're going to do 33% by the year 2020. And six, seven states have already put this in place, and some of their deadlines are a lot closer than 2025, at least 25% or more. Now, so, you know, just like the federal government is now saying cars on a fleet average need to have 54 some out miles per gallon. Getting to 27, which is what we have now for the fleet average, didn't cause too much upset, I don't think. And everybody needs more gas mileage because the price of gas is going up. So I think if that wasn't there, I really doubt, it's my personal opinion, that the automakers would work so hard and to achieve that. Now, you'd think it would, to give people more economical cars, that would be incentive to do it, but they hadn't done it. They hadn't done it for years and years, and then Japan and other manufacturers show them people want more economical cars and better quality cars, and that was like 60s and 70s and 80s that happened. So that's why GM almost went under, because they weren't responding to the market. And of course, some people might say, let them go, but awful lot of workers there, a lot of tangential losses too. But 2025, you know, business people, or at least some business people, say it's going to cost us a lot. It won't bring that many jobs. So tell us.
Well, I definitely think that California is struggling. California is underwater all the way. So for them to make a claim, and I've lived in California, I lived in Los Angeles. You know, I know that area. My family, some of my family's still there. There is no way they're going to make that deadline that they're saying for themselves. And if they do, everybody's going to be on bicycles. Because
I love bicycles, by the way.
Yeah, bicycles are great.
They're actually a great
answer.
They're
hard on the freeways.
Well, that's why we need bike paths, but yes. Anyway.
Well, yeah. Bike paths are so great.
You support bike paths in the legislature? No, but
I think bike paths have their place.
It's crazy, but by thanks to the federal government, Detroit is bike paths on Michigan Avenue, but not in Dearborn, but in Detroit, in areas that I personally wouldn't ride after dark of Michigan Avenue. But they have beautiful, brand-new bike paths, which I would use if the neighborhoods were a little better. But, you know, where's Dearborn? I mean, okay, we're not Detroit, but we should. I mean, Michigan Avenue, for a lot of it, at least in the center of town, is perfectly wide enough for bike paths and transport. I live only 3 miles away, but I'd be risking my life to try to get here from East Dearborn, trying to ride around Fairlane Town Center. No sidewalks there. I understand bike paths are part of a plan, but nobody knows how to do it yet. Some year our city government and the county may come up with a way to get to Henry Ford Community College by bike from the east side of town. And I don't want a recreational path that meanders. I want a direct route, you know. I don't want to have to even stop at every stop. I want bike paths that'll really get me here quickly. It's only 3 miles. I should be able to get here faster than cars, you know, 10 miles an hour on a bike, typically.
I'm going to get him a jet pack, I think, for Christmas.
Well, we have to sum up. It's so great to meet you and let our listeners know. Priscilla Parnas is running as Republican for 15th District in Michigan House on the November 6th ballot. Give you one last minute, summarize why you should be chosen by voters for this office. And we know you are running against, your only competition is George DeRaney, the Democrat. But what can you add to this office that we need?
Well, the main thing that I see between George and myself, I think he's a very nice man. I think he's done a lot of good for this area. And I'd like to see him continue to be involved in helping our state in our district as well. But on the other hand, I believe I could do a better job. I don't believe in our taxes going for everything that we can think of. I think our taxes are supposed to hit primarily our public safety. That's first and foremost, and our budget here in Dearborn reflects that. We have a very important way of dealing with that, and that is cutting the taxes while trying to increase the services that those taxes represent or those taxes go toward. And I think I could do a better job, in my opinion. And I think that my experience in politics, as well as I've worked for FEMA. I've gone out on national disasters. I've run national disasters. I've been in Child Protective Services. I've been a teacher. I've been a homemaker. I'm a mother, a grandmother, etc. I think we've got to get a hold of what's happening to our pocket.